You're listening to Intellectual Erection,
a place where we talk about the naughty.
To stimulate your thinking.
You're listening
to
Intellectual Erection.
Intellectual Erection.
Передачу, где мы говорим о диспуте, там субъекты секса.
Hablamos de los sex.
В компаниях, но мы говорим о
информации.
To stimulate your thinking. Welcome to another episode of Intellectual Erection with your host, Patrick. Well, actually today I'm not really your host. That's what's different about this episode. Today I'm featuring Anima Mea.
You've been knighted.
God. I think you have to have a penis to be knighted.
Do you?
I'm pretty sure.
Do they check?
No, but you know what they do check for in popes? They make sure that you have balls and a penis.
Why?
Because...
So you can diddle little boys?
Well...
Maybe we can edit that one out.
Yeah, we can certainly fucking edit that part out.
So that's Anima Mea, who is a brand new podcaster to the scene, and she's about to launch her very own show, Call Me Sentimental, a podcast about heartbreak, love, relationships, modern dating, taboo subjects, secret societies, and all that fun jazz. So she's treating me as her guinea pig, and I'm going to be interviewed for this episode, so you get to find out more about me. Ooh, who cares about this guy? I don't know. Hopefully somebody. So that's what we're doing on this episode. I hope you enjoy it. She does dig deep into the emotional disturbances that make up this host, why this podcast was created, and some pretty interesting stuff on sex positivity, kink, BDSM, all of this fun stuff that we do. But before we start the episode, let me update you on what's going on with Intellectual Erection. If you're following on the Insta at intellectual_erection, you know that what's coming up soon is going to be exciting. The Project Panties is well underway, and we're going to be at Oasis Aqua Lounge on April 20th for the Panty Parade and Play Party, where we're going to be selling some used panties of Intellectual Erection worn by the very nice models that you've seen on the Instagram, as well as some fresh pairs of panties because there's been demand for them. Apparently, people like the way these panties look. They're good quality, according to the models who have tried and worn them, and they look pretty fucking nice. So come out and support Intellectual Erection. It is currently unfunded. I have the Patreon out there. Money would be helpful since this podcast does cost money, time, labor, resources to produce, and it's free to listen to. So if you are willing and you are interested, visit patreon.com/intellectualerection. It's posted in the description of every episode, and you can support this podcast if you enjoy it. We have tiers as low as $1. We have $5, $20, $50, $100. And if not that, at least come out and support Project Panties. It's going to the podcast, to the models, and to Maggie's Toronto, a sex workers' rights NGO. And you get a nice pair of panties, either clean or worn, for your pervy desires. Other than that, as always, like, subscribe, listen, review, and most of all, as always, enjoy.
Let's actually start this interview, because I've been derailing you with my comedic wit.
Okay. So what inspired you to create your podcast?
Ooh. That was, that's something I actually, I was interviewed about on Aaron Pym's podcast, the Bedpost podcast. So story goes like this. I was supposed to do an academic study on a topic that I was interested in. I wanted to talk about nonverbal consent. Because I had been at a conference in Tokyo, I'm doing my PhD in psychology, so I've been working on existentialism. But I go to this conference in Tokyo, and I run into somebody from Ryerson who's doing work on consent and enthusiastic consent. And as she's talking, I'm sitting there in the audience thinking, wow, this is important, but there's something that keeps being missed in all the consent literature, right? The stuff that she's citing, the stuff that I heard before, and with the enthusiastic consent, I'm like, I'm excited, I like it, but there's something that's being missed. And I see it all the damn time at sex clubs is nonverbal consent, right? Nonverbal consent is something that I thought needs to be theorized. We need to be able to talk about it. We need to be able to address it because it exists, right?
Okay. So what is nonverbal consent?
So nonverbal cues of distress, of joy, of pleasure. It's things that we're used to seeing. It's like if I look at you and I see your face right now, you have a sort of like a slightly furrowed brow because you're interested in what I'm saying and you're curious and you're anticipating an answer that you don't know what is going to be, right? So it's a face of anticipation. We're good at reading body language, mm-hmm. right? We're good at it from birth. We recognize faces as babies. We're really fucking good at that. So to ignore this whole aspect of body language, which makes up a huge component of our communication, is, I think, irresponsible, especially when we're talking about consent, because there's going to be situations where body language becomes important and we should be checking in. We should be checking in with our partners to make sure that they're all right, to make sure that they want to continue, and that's part of ongoing consent. So I'm not trying to separate it from verbal consent, but I'm trying to add it to it, right? Because some people get away with really nasty shit because somebody didn't verbalize their needs.
So by checking in, so if there's nonverbal consent, could somebody nonverbally check in?
Yeah. If somebody is looking at you and asks you the question, are you okay? You could give them a thumbs up, right?
No, but I mean the person that's checking in. Like if you can have nonverbal consent, can you have a nonverbal check-in?
Yeah, look at
like
me now.
Like a thumbs up, right?
Look at me
now. Okay, I got it.
Yeah, you see that face, right? Like, I raise my eyebrows, I nod my head, and I show you my thumb, and I'm waving my hand with my thumb raised. Mm-hmm. And simultaneously, it looks like I'm asking, you okay?
Right.
Now, of course, these things aren't necessarily cross-cultural, but I just think it's something that we're missing and that we need to talk a little bit about, at least to get an idea of like people's experiences. So that was my plan. I went to interview people because I didn't have the answer. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to play the expert. I didn't have the answer, but I'm fascinated by the idea and I see it. And I see it as the territory specifically where people get away with shitty behaviors. Because if you're, say you're a sub and you are part of a scene and you've consented to it beforehand, and then during the scene, there's something you don't like. You want it to stop, but you don't want to be embarrassed. You don't want to displease your dom. Maybe you're in public. You don't want to cause a scene. So you just overlook it.
So can you just describe what a sub and a dom is for those of them out there that may not know what that is?
So in BDSM, which stands for bondage, domination, submission, sadism and masochism, the DS part is usually dom sub, dominant and submissive, sometimes called also top and bottom. Although that is borrowed from gay literature and culture. So dom-sub, DS relationships usually refer to a power dynamic in which hopefully there's a consensual basis for that power exchange. And it plays on the master-slave narrative where one person is endowed with power. Their power and authority over you can be, to do things to your body. You allow them to explore your body, to punish you, to inflict certain levels of pain, pleasure, and so on. And as the submissive, you're expected to take commands and to follow instructions and to receive, typically in the relationship, the pleasure, the pain, and whatever's being given. Now, that's simplified because there's an exchange, there's emotions involved, there's a whole slew of things, but typically it's a power exchange. And the dom is endowed with power, which for me also means responsibility. Therefore, I think the ethics leans heavily towards the dom side to be ethical. And then subs, because they're in the vulnerable position and they cede power willingly, consensually, need to be ethically considered. Just like you would in a society where you have a dominant class and a non-dominant, marginalized minority class, you know, you want to be able to acknowledge that those power relations exist and maybe do something about it. In the case of BDSM, we acknowledge that those power relations exist in the world, and that's what makes it taboo. That's what makes it sexy. That's why we want to fuck with it, is because we know that those things exist in the world and we want to play it out, That's the whole notion of taboo in sex, is taking something that exists that's dangerous, unpleasant, painful, and you turn it into an experience where you get to control it, you get to play with it, and you get to have it your way.
It almost reminds me of, you know how there's this notion that comedians are actually very depressed, and then they end up using a lot of their painful experiences and translating it into human or humor with their stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me of that for some reason.
Yeah, I could see that. I could see that. I mean, I've certainly met a lot of people in the sex-positive communities that are people that have had some shitty experiences, that mm-hmm. have been vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And because they've been through those shitty experiences, they now maybe would like to have a little bit of control. And your sex life is one of those great places where you can, provided you live in the right context, are surrounded by good communities and people, and have good support, which isn't the case, unfortunately, for everybody. But
mm-hmm. So yeah. what is the sex positive community?
I think it's an umbrella term that I started using because I got tired of just saying the long version, which is polyamory, kink, BDSM, you know, fetish, and then even under there's subcategories of that too, right?
Right.
Bondage, domination, submission, sadomasochism, DDLG, so many things that... So I just group it together under sex-positive communities, and I think it makes sense, and I haven't had anybody provide a counter-argument to me using it, so I'm going to keep using it unless somebody gives me a reason not to.
Do you think that people that identify as polyamorous are kinkier or have more fetishes than people that don't? Than people that don't identify as polyamorous?
If you would have asked me this a while ago, I would have said yes, because that was my assumption and my intuition going in. Just because people that are polyamorous tend to be more communicative. It's part of the experience of being polyamorous that you tend to have to communicate a little bit more than you would otherwise, because you're navigating multiple relationships potentially, and it's demanded by the community. It's part of one of the community standards. If you're going to be polyamorous, is there's certain expectations, there's norms, just like there's norms within the heteronormative monogamous community, mm-hmm. right? About jealousy, about betrayal, about certain things. They're not spoken, but we know them.
Mm-hmm.
And in the poly community, good communication, honesty, and transparency is valued. So the people that are successful at polyamory tend to have those qualities. And because of that, they'll tend to be a little bit more candid about their kinks, fetishes, and sexual proclivities. So it will give you the impression that these people tend to be more inclined towards kink, BDSM, fetishes, and so on. But after having interviewed people a little bit more, I realize that it might not be the case. It might be the case that all of us are potentially interested in some kinks, fetishes, and certain types of play that excite us. It's just that we're not all comfortable or given the opportunity to express them. So it's a hard thing to say without empirical evidence and without getting into the people's brains.
So
this is why, actually, I realized I didn't finish answering your first question, which is how the podcast started.
Right.
So, yeah. No. It's fine. Well, this is the beauty of having a sort of like open interview like this is you trail off, and that's better than being quiet and mm-hmm. awkward, right? So
yeah.
I completely think we're on a good path. But I was reminded because of what I was just talking about. So the non-consent stuff, I tried to propose it as a research thing, and I spoke to the sex lab at Ryerson, spoke to York, and they both kind of dissuaded me. They're like, you know what, it's the Me Too movement. There's a lot of literature on consent, and it's not your area of expertise. You're, you know, in a different area. You're in psychology doing different things. You're focused on existentialism. You haven't done much work in, gender studies and sexuality, and there's potential landmines that you wouldn't even foresee.
Mm-hmm.
So after they told me that, I'm like, yep, that probably makes sense. And it's good that, you know, that they did tell me that. But I was still very passionate about this stuff. I'm still very much engaged with the communities. So I'm like, you know what? I want to still do something. So I decided to do the podcast as a way of providing a space for these voices to be heard.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, it alleviates me that responsibility of having to draw any conclusions about,
right,
you know, what consent and nonverbal consent ought to look like. I'm not the author,
right,
of the thing. I'm now the host or the interviewer, and I'm here to listen and learn from people.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have to come up with conclusions. We get to talk, and people get to express themselves. And the burden isn't on them either to theorize nonverbal consent with a conclusive answer. We can have undecidability.
Mm-hmm.
We can have questions, and questions can sometimes stimulate thinking, which is good enough.
Yeah. And I found it very educational, personally, listening to your podcast.
Why, thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm complimented, flattered, honored, all the goods.
So earlier you mentioned something called enthusiastic consent.
Yes.
What does that mean?
That means like, woo, fuck me now.
Oh, okay.
Woo!
Okay.
It's
literally like, it's pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the importance of enthusiastic consent, okay, here's why it's important. You can obtain consent through negotiation, coercion, manipulation, or straight up asking. In the best case scenario, you can get a unenthusiastic yes because somebody's being polite.
Okay.
But maybe they don't want to have sex with you that day, but they're like, oh, I guess they've been waiting so long. They're being considerate, but toward you, but not toward themselves.
Okay.
So in the best case scenario, you've obtained consent because you asked politely, but the other person just didn't want to say no because they didn't want to disappoint you.
I see.
And if you're able to read any kind of body language, or you see that it's not a yes with enthusiasm, but like a, okay, sure, why not?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Then yeah, you got your consent, but maybe you'd say, are you sure? Double check with the person and say, we can do this another time, or we don't have to do it at all. I don't want to make you feel like you're pressured or whatever. And then if the person's like, no, I was just a little tired, but I do really want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that once I get going, it's going to be fun. And I don't want to miss the opportunity to play with you. Then if you get that, you say, okay, if you're sure, yeah. But if they say, well, yeah, I guess I'm a little tired and I'm not feeling super fresh today. Do you mind if we postpone? And you say, no, of course not.
Mm-hmm.
I want you at your best. And,
right,
you know. That's the difference. That's in the best case scenario. In the worst case scenario, somebody says, I'm not really sure. I don't know if I'm interested. And you keep asking. You persuade. You manipulate. You coerce. Right? And you turn a no into a yes. And if you've done that, yeah, I see you cringing. If you've been there and you've had it done to you, or if you've done that, you know, reflecting on it should not make you feel good on either end of,
mm-hmm,
whether you were the one doing it or receiving it. Now, during this Me Too movement,
right, for sure,
it's awakened a lot of people to. So enthusiastic consent is, you know, making sure that the person really wants what you're asking them to participate in.
Mm-hmm.
That's the difference.
Okay. So if somebody has a kink or a fetish and they haven't necessarily come out yet,
mm-hmm,
and they have a partner, what would you say is like the best way for them to approach their partner about talking about their fetish or their kink?
I mean, it's almost foreign to me now to think from a perspective where I don't have an open line of communication with somebody,
okay,
about these things, and I know how difficult it can be. I've been, mm-hmm, there myself, and I've had to open these conversations, and I just know it took a lot of time, a lot, yeah, of effort, and sometimes people can surprise you and they'll be into it and, mm-hmm, they'll totally support you, or they can be completely turned off by it, shocked, and shame you for it, which, mm-hmm, would really suck. If you know enough about your partner, you might be able to gauge what kind of response you'd get.
Mm-hmm.
If it's the shaming response, and you know, you're pretty sure that's a shaming response, and this is something that's important to you, and you want to try these things, and it's not just oh, these are some kinks that I'd like to try. These are maybe you have some fetishes that you need to mm-hmm. try, and it's been bugging you and it's been eating at you, and you want to go outside of your relationship and find an escort to try them with, which I think a lot of people goes through their heads, or they cheat, or they find avenues to satisfy something that their partners are not willing, not interested in doing. I mean, in an ideal world, you go to your partner and you say, this is what I need for sexual gratification. Need, not want. What I want is more negotiable. What I need feels like I'm being suffocated if I don't have it. In that case, that partner can either respond by being open to try it with you. If it's not their jam,
mm-hmm.
if you want to try anal and your partner doesn't, don't force them.
Mm-hmm.
But if you say, this is like, maybe your partner would be okay with you trying it with somebody else. And if not, then, you might come up to that point in your relationship where you feel like you have to end it because you're not getting what you want in the relationship. If your emotional needs aren't being met, people leave relationships. Mm-hmm. Well, the same thing can happen because of sexual needs mm-hmm. not being met. And that happens in relationships. Sex gets dry, boring, and people cheat or they leave. So, unfortunately, you don't really know, because we're not trained in the heteronormative monogamous schema to negotiate our needs before engaging in a relationship. We're told that we're kind of informed that it's all like a sweeping motion. You get swept away by love, and it's authentic and it's genuine because...
But it is!
No, and I'm not saying that it's not. You do get romantic. Of course. I'm romantic too. I think that you do get swept away. But that doesn't mean you're going to be compatible.
Right. Yeah, that's very true. Right?
I think you can fall in love with a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say that I believe there's the soulmate or the one-on-one. You can feel that way, and I'm not going to say you don't.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say you do. If you feel that way and you think you have your soulmate and that's just the one, I'm great. I wish, the best for you. And maybe if I found that, I'd be just as happy as you are.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But, in my experience, I've seen a lot more people fall in love with many people.
Right.
And that's just because you're incompatible doesn't mean the love wasn't real. It was real. It was great. You had your dopamine rush. You mm-hmm. had the butterflies in the dopamine center of your body, which is your gut. And animals experience it too. Your dog has a dopamine rush when it sees you, if it loves you.
Wow.
Or other animals. So, it's biochemical, but it's also valid. It's also an embodied experience. It's phenomenal. There's a phenomenological aspect to it. You don't just feel a dopamine rush, because I could replicate the dopamine rush with a drug and you wouldn't be falling in love. It would be temporary and it'd be euphoric, versus falling in love is a little bit more sustained, and you like the smell and the look of the person, and you want to see them and you crave them and you want their lips, or you want their neck, or you want the touch of their skin. You want them sleeping beside you. You want this thing
mm-hmm.
and you want it in multifarious and different ways, whereas a drug does it in particularly one way, and it could be very effective, but it's not the same thing. There's a difference in quality of experience there.
Do you know anything about limerence?
The what?
Limerence.
the what? Limerence? Is that like a limerick that's pronounced wrong?
No.
What is that?
Limerence. It's like the state that you're in when you first meet somebody that you're super into, and you go through like an infatuation stage with them. It's like a whole psychological thing that happens to your brain.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I know it intimately, but I didn't know it was called.
Right, yeah.
How do you spell this limerent?
L-I-M-E-R-A-N-C-E. Limerence.
Oh, limerence.
Yes.
So it's a state. It's a state of infatuation.
Yeah, I think I'm going to do a whole episode on limerence.
I like it. Mm-hmm. I've limerenced.
Me too.
Many a time.
Oh yeah, me too. I get super obsessed.
I know, it's such a good rush.
It is, but it's so like damaging.
The come down sucks. coming down off that stuff sucks.
Oh my god, it's the worst.
Oh my god, but it's, you crave it though. Like once in a while, you're just like, I want to meet that one fucking person that just, drives me up the wall, and I want to just go you know, bananas with them, get wild, and then see what happens, get messy.
And then watch it crash and burn, and watch your life fall apart around you.
Well, I mean, from my existential side of things, it's like, you got to ask the question, at least once in your mortality, when you realize you're going to die, is what is the point of life if it's temporary? What's the point of life if it ends? Everything has a finite end,
mm-hmm.
at least in your world it does. It doesn't matter if you can imagine things that last forever. Your world's going to end. So mm-hmm. what's the point in something that ends? All your joy, all your experiences, and sure, some people have beliefs in afterlives and blah, 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 and all these things, but it doesn't pertain to this world. Like, once you're gone from here, you don't have a connection with the people here. Even in like Christian heaven.
I disagree, but that's okay.
I mean, that experience is not the same as the experience you're having now.
It's not the physical experience.
Yeah.
Yes.
So in what we can say for sure is that once you've died, you cease to have the same connections with the people that continue to live. In that, namely, those people cannot access you in the physical way that they used to. Okay, that we can say with some level of certainty.
Yes.
So, you know, because all these things end, it's like, what's the point? What's the meaning? You know, and if you're like me and you're a cynic and you lean more towards you know, atheistic beliefs, and you're not into mysticism, spirituality, religion, and you don't have an afterlife waiting for you or a promise that you can't prove right now, then you might have this feeling like it's all for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Like you get one ride, and maybe, I guess, you got to be glad about the fact that you get to ride at all.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you parallel that with an experience of love,
mm-hmm.
right, and you look at life, you say life is a lot of suffering. You get to go through a lot of suffering. You're going to get heartbreak, you're going to get family members that die, friends that die, and a lot of bad things are going to happen to you, and you're going to feel them. And a lot of bad things are going to happen to a lot of other people. And maybe if you're compassionate enough, you're going to feel that too. So what's the point in it all? And then you get to die. You get to, you know, have it end for you too. At least in one way,
mm-hmm.
if that's all that can be said. So if you parallel that with love, what's the point in falling in love with somebody when you know that you're going to have the joy, but then you're going to have the misery? You're going to find out, the worst part is the first moment you look at your partner and you find that first thing that you don't like about them.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, fuck, there it is.
Yep.
Or like waiting on the first argument, and you wait. And you're like, what's the first thing we're going to disagree upon? And then you disagree. And sometimes it gets really nasty. And a lot of relationships end. Most of them end. Very few people have their first sweetheart monogamous relationship that ends in death. But even that ends. So what's the point? Why do we do it? And after heartbreak, if you've had one, if you've had two, you should know better than to ever do it again. But yet we do.
Well, we can't help the way we feel.
Because we want it, we crave it. And we're like, you know what, at the end of the day, it's still worth it, because the beauty is maximized by the suffering of it. You know, adversity pushes the joy and you know, all of it together. You have your highs and your lows, and that could be said about life. Even as a pessimist, you could say, well, we might all die, and the universe has a finite end, and I don't believe in anything you know, spiritual or an afterlife, but it's amazing that I get to be here and be part of this like messy adventure. And isn't it wild?
It's so wild.
Right?
It's so wild.
You get to figure things out. You get to make mistakes.
Yeah. But I feel like a lot of the times when we fall in love, it's not a choice.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Well, just like being alive.
Right.
That's what I mean. It's a pretty good parallel in that sense. Right? Like, you happen upon it.
Right, yeah. Yeah,
you happen to live, and you're like, oh, I'm here.
Yeah.
Why?
Why do you think we're here?
Oh, what is the meaning of life?
Tell me, Patrick.
Oh, geez. The answer to the universe is 43. I don't know. I mean, if I had it figured out...
Yeah.
If I had it figured out, I think I'd be the only one.
Okay, so then we can switch it.
Do you want my answer? Like, sure, for me, yeah, personally, I think it's a sense of eudaimonia, which is a sense of fulfillment. It's as opposed to a hedonistic pleasure or happiness, where you just indulge in the senses. I think it's a happiness that you get out of finding meaning. You get to explore the meaning of the world through its all-encompassing beauty, which means pleasure as well as tragedy. And I'm a person who's kind of obsessed with suffering. And I assess my suffering, and I have a sick enjoyment of it as much as it damages me. Because in the process of witnessing my own suffering, it's like, you know that moment when you're crying and you look at yourself in the mirror, or you force yourself to cry more because it feels good to get it out? That's me with suffering, right? Like, I want to see how far it goes. I want to challenge myself. It's almost like challenge accepted suffering. Okay, let's see who fucks with who more, right? Is the suffering going to get me, or am I going to get it? And me getting it means me understanding it, me coming to terms with it and seeing how can I use this adversity to my advantage. And I think, of course, a lot of that comes with privilege and context and reflexivity. Being a white male certainly fucking helps. Having no, you know, visible disabilities and impediments in my life, of course, is a privilege that grants me the exercise of frolicking with my existential anxieties and being able to indulge in these things. So I do try to be aware of that as well. And I know that for some people, that is not the most important thing in their lives to find meaning, is to, assess my suffering. Because some people just suffer because of others. Some people suffer because of systematic reasons and because of shitty other people. And they're not given the opportunity to lay back and armchair philosophize about their suffering like I do. So I'm fully aware that it's, for me, it's something that comes with some level of privilege.
Do you find that you draw inspiration from your suffering? Do you find that it helps you, like, academically, and it helps you with various other things that you want to be inspired about in your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's, because I get this privilege to assess it in these ways, and it's not debilitating to a degree that it is for other people, I think that it almost comes with a level of responsibility for me to try to work it out. Because I could just as easily ignore it. I could do things that are a lot easier in my life and not assess my suffering, not deal with it, not use it as a motivational tool to achieve certain things in my life. So I think it's part of creating meaning, and it's part of my responsibility of having the advantage to be able to deal with my suffering in the way that I do.
Do you find that you assess your current existing suffering, or do you find that you look for experiences or situations in which you will experience suffering so that you can further assess different levels of suffering?
I don't seek it. It's like, I don't seek suffering, but I'm always, it's hard to say prepared, because you're never really prepared, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
I think I always try to prepare for future suffering.
Mm-hmm.
I spend a lot of time obsessing about that, ruminating and, you know, going over past experiences and anticipated future experiences where I'm not going to succeed. I'm not going to get what I want. I'm going to fail. People are gonna stop loving me, and they're not going to be around, or any of these shitty situations. I do kind of think about those things a lot. Does that mean that when I get there, the ideal me is there, prepared, and handles it well? No.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't handle it well, is usually devastated, and tries, or I try my best in those instances to pull myself up and to say that it's okay. Like, it's kind of part of the human experience. I expected it to happen to some degree. I anticipated it. I didn't want it to happen. It's like the prepare for the worst and hope for the best
mm-hmm.
mentality. So when I'm there, it's like, yeah, I tried to prepare for the worst, but in hoping for the best, I, you know, didn't want this to happen. So I'm still here. I'm still dealing with the shittiness of it all. But I'm trying to theorize this idea that maybe acknowledging that it's okay and that we all have some level of suffering maybe just alleviates it enough so that it doesn't debilitate us as much as it otherwise would.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a theory in psychology that is called defensive pessimism. It's like you imagine the worst case scenario and you prepare for it mentally. You say, mm-hmm. what am I going to do in this circumstance if this happens? And you detail it and outline it and you write it down. And usually the worst doesn't happen, so you're okay. But if it does happen, you have a plan.
Right.
Yeah. So I think having that plan is kind of just knowing that in life you are going to suffer. It's not going to be all good. And even if it isn't all good, it's not all bad.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. There's a lot that goes into it. I'm still
trying to unwrap it all.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get it. A lot of the reason why I wanted to start my own podcast is because of my own suffering. And processing my own suffering.
There you go. As my intuition informs me, as I think a lot of people, I think there's a person out there who says they haven't suffered.
Of course, everybody suffers. But I, in my own suffering, what I kept thinking of is, oh my God, there's so many other people that suffer this way every day. And I'm very fortunate that, you know, I have suffered in my life, but certainly not as much as some other people have.
Yeah.
And when I was in my, like, you know, lower points, I just thought to myself, I wish that I could reach more people that were going through the same thing.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what spearheaded a lot of, like, the content that I'm putting together for my episodes.
Yeah, and I think you're onto something with that. I think the part of the responsibility of dealing with your suffering is kind of finding a sense of community with it and being like, yeah, it's suffering can feel very alienating,
mm-hmm.
but when we recognize that all of us, you know, have some level of it, then it can bring us together and we mm-hmm. could be like, how can we be less shitty to each other and employ the strategies of, you know, the ethics of care, mm-hmm. compassion and love and empathy towards each other. Because there's so much suffering, we can actively do things to reduce it. And you know, I do, like you were saying, you acknowledge that there's people who suffer worse than you. And like I said, I acknowledge my privilege in having my forms of suffering that are not completely debilitating. So in that, you also have to acknowledge the authenticity of your suffering on its own grounds, as well as in context, I think. Because there's something important about you being validated. And that's the first kind of basis of therapy. So when you go to a therapist, they'll validate your feelings,
mm-hmm.
right? You have a reason why you're feeling this way. You have a reason why it pains you to exist and because of your experiences. And that shouldn't be taken away because you acknowledge that other people suffer worse than you. Yes,
right,
they do.
Of course.
Yes, they do, but that's their experience. And that shouldn't diminish your experience because it will not help necessarily for you to think these people are doing so much worse. Therefore, you feel the double guilt of not even being able to assess your own suffering because you feel guilty for complaining about something that seems relatively minute.
Right. I think where I was kind of coming from with it in my thought process was that, as you said, when you're suffering, it can feel very alienating.
Yeah.
So I imagined that feeling in other people. And,
yeah.
you know, as you also said, you wanted to, maybe I'm trying to build some sort of safe space and community for those people to feel those feelings and also realize that they're not alone in those feelings.
Absolutely.
So I didn't necessarily diminish or like, I didn't feel like my suffering wasn't valid. Because there's so many other people that suffer in worse ways than I do. I think what I wanted to do, maybe for my own reward, I guess, is if I can reach somebody who is experiencing the same things and maybe make their burden of suffering a little bit lighter, it made me feel better. It makes me feel better to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It also relieves my suffering.
Right. So that was, the idea behind the thing that I said with the communal experience of reducing alienation is that by sharing in ethics of care, it generally improves the collective good, right?
Right. So this actually takes me back to another question that I wanted to ask you. So if somebody had a kink or a fetish and they wanted to find like-minded individuals, mm-hmm. where would you suggest that they start?
I mean, the first line of, not defense, what is it? Whatever. The first place they should, most people would go is usually online, right? Because you get to be anonymous, you get to search for things, and you don't have to put yourself out there to the same degree that you would in a physical interaction in the world. Online can have great resources, it could have very misleading resources, and it's replete with creeps. So I would suggest, yeah, you could go to places like FetLife.com and see a bunch of people's profiles, get trapped in their super sexy nudes, and, you know, browse that, put up your own profile. But if you're usually a femme person and you post pictures of yourself on FetLife, you're going to get a lot of creeps. A lot of creeps. Even me as a guy posting pictures, I've gotten some creeps.
Wow.
So it can happen. I mean, anytime you get into, like, you know, these kind of taboo, seedier communities, you might encounter people who are a little creepy. So I think it's a lot safer or less threatening to do things in real life. That's weird saying in real life. Yeah, to go out and meet people in person is what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
You get a better judge of character, and like the interaction tends to be a little bit more fluid. Even though people are scared to do it, I think that a lot of the sex positive communities have good bases of support, communication, and you can go to sex clubs where they have seminars, classes, meet and greets, or you can go to FetLife and find events and munches where people will go to a social and drink and chat at a bar, coffee shop, and you get to meet some people. And I think that the most comforting thing you can find is somebody who will talk to you about it with some level of experience and make you feel okay about it. Versus online, you could find that, mm-hmm. but you, I don't know.
You have to be cautious.
Yeah, I mean, not that, like I said, I'm not an expert on any of this stuff, so I speak from my limited experience. So, I mean, it could be the case that statistically people do better finding things online than in person, but from my experience, I prefer doing the in-person thing, and I don't know what it's like to be not a guy. Right. Who identifies as a guy going to a social or a munch or a sex club.
So what's a munch?
It's basically a social, okay. From what I understand. It's a social where people get together and talk about something to do with one of the sex-positive communities.
Interesting.
Oh, just like a social gathering. So yeah, I mean, yeah, if you're a cis man, you know, the in-person thing can work, unless you're the creep. If you're the creep, then don't. Just don't be a creep, you know? Learn to
PSA, be nice. Don't be a creep.
Try not to be a creep. Some mm-hmm. people are creepy and they don't know they're creepy, which
right.
sucks.
Yeah.
Try to... I don't know. I don't know what my... I don't know what my advice is. Just don't be creepy. Try not to be creepy. Don't make people uncomfortable. Don't make them feel weird.
Yeah. Do you recommend that if somebody... Places. If somebody feels like their fetish is super creepy, like, is there any way that they can educate themselves in how to feel more comfortable with their kink or their fetish?
Well, is their fetish super creepy?
I don't know.
Well, you're giving me the hypothetical. So if are you imagining somebody who does have a creepy fetish, or somebody who's got a fetish and they just think it's creepy?
It's creepy, yeah.
Which one?
Like the second one. So like, let's say they...
Okay, so they just think it's creepy.
Let's say there's a guy that has a foot fetish.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's not creepy.
I know, but I'm just giving you an example.
Yeah.
And, you know, this person just can't reconcile this, like, fetish
mm-hmm.
or kink, whatever.
Yeah.
What would you say to that person to make them feel better about it?
I'm talking to this person?
Yeah.
I'd be like, listen... I'm like, your fetish is almost vanilla at this point.
Yeah.
Like, you're on the surface of fetishes, and you should feel empowered to explore your fetish and enjoy it. You know, I would tell them not to feel bad. Don't feel weird or bad about your fetish, because I know people who have fetishes that would blow your mind, and I love them for it, because it's wonderful to meet nuanced weirdos who explore these things, and there's places and people that will not only accept you but want you there. So I would say there's literature, there's forums online and websites where you can meet these people. And if you live in Toronto, hi, there's sex clubs and there's munches and socials, and you can go on FetLife and you can go to the websites of any of the sex clubs and find events and meet people and engage with them. Yeah.
So I'm going to go to the sex club.
The sex club.
Am I going to make love in the club? Who knows?
Make love in the club. Jeez, that's the first time ever. That's the first time I heard somebody go talk about a sex club. Make love in the sex club.
It's an Usher song.
In the club?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways, right. So do you have any tips or recommendations for me in preparing myself for this experience?
Get a whip, get some chains.
So I was actually wondering, like, could I disguise myself? Would it be totally weird if I walked in wearing a wig and, like, maybe a Venetian a Venetian mask?
Nope, you'd be fitting right in.
Perfect.
And, well, not all sex clubs are alike, but, you know, in the good ones, you walk in as you are and you're good.
Okay.
Whatever that means for you. So, tips, advice, try not to overthink. Go and pretend like you're on Star Trek and you're exploring a new planet.
Yeah, like I'm kind of going in as like, yeah. I'm calling it research.
Yeah, go in like Spock would, and you're just like looking around and you're studying and you're seeing how people interact in a different environment than you're used to. That way you don't feel the pressure to participate and engage, and you have your distance, and hopefully if the experience is nice, you'll feel welcomed and you'll not feel like you have to put up a front to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Which has been my experience and the experience of many people that I've talked to. But then again, that could be because most of the people that I talk to are the people that continue to go to sex clubs. So maybe I just haven't met the ones that went once and left.
So is it one of those things where when you go once, is it almost like people that have, so I don't have any tattoos, but people that have tattoos always tell me once you get one, you keep wanting more. So it's like, is it the same kind of thing as sex clubs, as then you go once and you keep wanting to go back?
Well, for some of us, yes. But I'm sure there's plenty of people out there who have just one tattoo and don't want more.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll get a tattoo at the sex club.
Get a tattoo at the sex club while you're wearing your Venetian mask and your wig. I think that sounds like a game plan. Yeah, I mean, try it out. Explore. And don't feel pressured. If you ever do feel pressured in a sex club at all, leave that sex club.
Mm.
That's my advice. The good ones will not make you feel that way. And it could be the place makes you feel that way, or it could be that people in the place make you feel that way, which there's a difference. If the people in a sex club or a person in a sex club makes you feel pressured, awkward, uncomfortable, address it to the people and the authorities in the sex club, the staff. If they do something about it, good. If they don't, leave that sex club. And if it's the whole environment and the people and the staff that make you feel uncomfortable and weird, then it's not for you. It could be that the place is creepy or that it's just not for you. So that's your cue to go. I haven't experienced that side of it. I've seen shitty people in sex clubs, and they usually get dealt with.
Okay.
So, you know.
And how would you prepare a complete fucking germaphobe like me for going into a fucking sex club for the first time? Is there going to be juices flowing everywhere? Is there going to be juices that are like kind of rolling on the floor, slowly making their way to my feet?
On a good night.
Oh, no.
Am
I going to have to burn my clothes and like bleach myself when I get home?
Only if it's a satanic ritual night. No, I mean, I think that I think that most of the time it has the at least the appearance of cleanliness. So I don't know. If you're
like, is there going to be golden showers everywhere?
No, there's no golden showers, and I've not seen shit on the walls or anything
no,
like that.
No, I wasn't expecting shit on the walls.
I haven't seen blood anywhere. I mean, there might have been, you know, blood can happen, and I haven't seen other bodily fluids in places being left behind.
Okay.
I've seen people squirt, I've seen people come, and I've seen it being cleaned up.
Okay.
In sex, or in like play spaces.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Yeah, so people aren't just jizzing on the seats at the bar and on the floors and no.
So, do you think I should like ask around for people that have been for what to expect, or should I just completely go in almost blindly and just see what fucking happens?
I mean, if you're worried about something, you can ask people specific questions.
I'm not worried necessarily. Yeah.
But I think you're the best judge of your experience. So at that point, it should be up to you how you feel about it. I would say go, and if you want to feel safe, bring one or two friends.
Yeah, no, of course. Like, yeah. I'm not going to go alone. I'm not going to go alone.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, bring one or two friends and make sure you have like people that you can rely on that will make you feel comfortable.
For sure.
It's a good idea if you can bring people that you trust, that make you feel safe, and that also are a little bit more confident than you in being there, because you don't want to be the one that has to like convince them to stay or have to worry about the, you know, them.
Right.
Right? You should be the noob in the situation and have the other people supporting you if they can.
Mm-hmm.
That would be, you know, ideal advice.
Okay.
You might not have that. You might be that one weirdo in your group that is the only one that wants to go to sex club and you don't have anybody to take you.
You know, actually, since I've been talking to some people, it's pretty surprising how many more people are curious and interested than
I
expected.
That's what I've been saying.
Right?
I think people are really fucking kinky and like
people are low key.
I think people are very, you know, very prone to
like
to a lot of these things.
Everybody is dying for me to go so that I can explain what it's like.
Take your squad goals. Hashtag 2019.
Yeah,
sex positivity.
Yeah.
Hashtag fuck the patriarchy. Right? I don't want to overemphasize the joy, because I also, you know, want people to be cautionary. And I know not everybody's had great experiences, but go have fun. Try it out and, you know, yeah.
Okay.
Be safe, be smart, enjoy.
Cool. So just two more questions.
Give me.
Have you ever had your heart broken?
Would I be such a pessimist and existentialist if I hadn't? Of course I have.
What helped you get over your heartbreak?
I don't know if I ever got over all of them. Got over some. When I was younger and I was more of a misogynist douche. Yeah, I was. I grew up with bad ideas and I had to unlearn them, which I'd like to be even more open about it. I like to be open about it. I like to be even more open about it. So back then I used hatred as a tool. Blame the other person, they did the wrong, and that made me feel justified and made me get over them. Fuck them, I don't need them, they were bad anyway. Try to employ that when you gain a sense of empathy and compassion. Not so much, doesn't work. When you see nuances, you can't use black and white thinking to totally paint, you know, an experience or a person in a particular way. So if you've had your heart broken and you can't get over it, then you're me.
And me.
Right? You're literally wearing your heart on your sleeve. Well,
know.
Not so much on your sleeve, it's on your shirt.
I know. This is my favorite sweater.
Yeah, it's cute.
Did you ever have like last words for somebody that you never got to say? Like, was there ever one that got away that you just like wanted to say something else to them, but you just couldn't?
I think so. I think, yeah. But here's the difference. There's this like, I think I'm overly analytical to a degree that's beyond good for me. So I see the ideal fictional me telling this person this thing that I want to say, and then they're hearing it, and I have the closure of having said it, and then their response is whatever, hopefully favorable. But then there's the realistic me, which sees the nuance of why we broke up to begin with, why things ended, and how this person isn't just this, you know, reducible experience of all good or all missed out or all like opportunity lost or all bad. You know, once I appreciate the nuances of a person, I realize that there's things that I liked about them, things I didn't like, things that I loved about them, and things that broke the relationship. Mm-hmm. And reasons why that was, and reasons why that can no longer be, or might no longer be the same, or that person might not want to hear what I have to say anymore. So if I think about, you know, the ones that got away and the things I never got to say, realistically, I don't think they care about what I have to say.
Well, in an ideal world, what would you say to them?
Well, in an ideal world, I'd say that like thing that made them turn around and be like, oh my God, I've been feeling the same thing too, and it sucks that things ended the way they did. Can we try to be friends? And with good relationships, at least since I've been polyamorous, I've had that. Mm-hmm. I have people that I've, you know, been partners with, and now we're friends, and I don't have to suffer those things. And I think that's one thing I really appreciate about polyamory. My monogamous relationships all ended. I don't talk to any of them except one person from when I was like 17, and she's an awesome person. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's the one really cool thing that happened in my serial monogamy, is having that one person that didn't break off completely and never heard from them again. You know, because unless a person was completely toxic and they need to be out of your life, then most people that you spend a considerable amount of time with have a lasting effect on you.
They do.
It'd be nice to at least have them around so that you can be reminded that this is who they are now, and they're not just this fiction in your head of this like perfect thing that you lost. They're actually a human that makes mistakes and is different and is maybe, you know, not what you want now. Because if you have them in your life, you have that evidence. If you don't, then you're constantly stuck in your own fictions. And that's the struggle with me too, because I suffer from the fictions. I realize the reality, but realizing the reality doesn't alleviate the suffering of the fictions, especially when you're at home alone in your bed and you sleep alone and you have to go to sleep with that thought that that person just isn't there.
Yeah.
You know? So nostalgia is a fucking asshole. Nostalgia is an asshole for that.
I know.
You know? And cuffing season now is especially hard, so take care of yourselves if you're going through this shit. Don't assume that that person that you lost is your saving grace. You can't be their savior, that can't be yours. And persons are just
I'm totally kidding.
I mean
I know that, but you know,
I know it feels that way, but what I'm saying is that there's other opportunities out there.
Of course.
You know, there's other opportunities for you to feel fulfilled and happy and joyous and have the things. And one of the constant things that I've been thinking about, somebody asked me the question, is it that you miss the person, or do you miss feeling of being loved? And if I assess the person, I miss some things about them. And some things I don't. Mm-hmm. And I think the things that I miss about them could be satisfied by somebody else.
Yeah.
So if you're lonely and you're suffering, you might just want love. You might not want that person you thought was the one for you, or the one that got away.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the ones you'll always remember, though. Ugh.
You know, somebody said to me, it's the relationship that could have been,
mm-hmm.
that you often reflect on your deathbed.
Yeah. My deathbed is every night when I go to sleep. I reflect on...
Oh, Patrick.
No, I mean, I'm being poetic.
Okay.
I'm being poetic. Allow me to be poetic.
Please.
Every night as I go to my deathbed. No, but it's pretty accurate, especially if I've been drinking, which is a self-medicating habit for people who suffer from depression, anxiety, heartbreak. They'll find ways to self-medicate.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you're alone, when you're alone by yourself in the absence of your friends, of other voices, and you have to bear the silence of your own consciousness, if that's persistently difficult to deal with, you might be depressed.
Mm-hmm.
You might need to seek therapy,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, whatever it is. But I get those moments. I get those moments a lot. Not every night, but on occasion. I've always been pessimistic, though, so it's not foreign to me.
Right.
You know?
Is there like a comfort and a familiarity in those feelings for you?
I don't know. It just fucking feels important. It just feels like my anxiety and my suffering and my anguish is important to me. It feels like it's like without it, I would not have a sense of meaning.
So it's a part of your identity.
Yeah, which is actually part of my my theorizing of existential angst for my dissertation. Is I think we're living in a kind of neo-nihilistic period, and it's justified. People have reasons to be cynical and to feel depressed and anxious now in the information age more than ever with the mm-hmm. political climate and what's going on in the world. It's justified, and I think people need to have those feelings validated. But I also think that there's a romanticism that we have with our own suffering. I think that we romanticize our own suffering, and that maybe it's just like that Stockholm syndrome where you become dependent on your abuser, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, if in the absence of my abuser, who is the happy me? Because I don't know that person. So it's really a conflict of interest for me to know what's best for me. You know what I mean? If I knew what was best for me, then again, I think I'd be the only one. So this is why help is important to be given and received.
Mm-hmm.
This is why your friends are important, and you should talk to them. And if they don't want to listen, tell them they have to fucking listen.
Yeah.
Tell them they have to fucking listen, because it's their job. That's you. You're my friend. You're gonna listen. You don't want to hear it about my suffering. You're gonna hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's why we're friends.
Yeah. And I'm a huge proponent of people seeking professional therapeutic help.
Yeah. I mean, don't use your friend as your therapist, but use your friends as
your friends for friendship purposes.
And communicate. You can communicate your suffering, hopefully, to your good friends. But yeah, definitely therapy is recommended. Recommended.
Do you have any final thoughts or final things that you want to share with the world?
I don't know. Am I on my deathbed again?
Yeah. Deathbed Shit. Talk. Give it to me.
I'm thinking about all the things I missed out on. Man, there was this one girl I fell in love with once. You know what? Isn't it fucking odd that you're alive?
It is fucking odd. Life is so odd. You're listening to Intellectual Erection, a place where we talk about the naughty to stimulate your thinking.